My contact and office information is on the syllabus. What I think you'll find, though, once we get into things, is that the lab gives a big block of time, because you're not continuously busy. And today will be totally different. Today I'll just be lecturing to you in lab. But usually you're doing some sort of procedure. And once you're doing that, it gives you a lot of time if you want to come up to me and talk about something one-on-one, rather than, you know, if it's convenient for you that to talk to me that way, that's one possibility. But I also have regular office hours that are listed, so you don't have to schedule anything. I'll just be in my office on those times. Just come in if you want. And, of course, email is available. That's how things are usually done. And as long as I'm not teaching or in a meeting or sleeping, I usually respond within 2 minutes. So be sure to check your replies after you ask me an email question. But if you really want a one-on-one without anyone around and the times don't work for you, or you feel like staying at home during the pandemic, then we can arrange a Zoom meeting. Just email me. That brings us, though, to the biological material for today. And I should say that you'll find pretty quickly, once I change slides, that my slideshows feature very little text, almost no text. They're almost entirely pictures. And I do that intentionally. It's not just laziness. The reason I do that is because even if I tell you, if I had slides with text, and I just tell you directly, do not write this text down, because it already exists online. You can print it out if you want it. The majority of people will do it anyway. Are you trying to get my attention? Just yell. You don't have to.
The textbooks don't have enough lecture. Do you need to bring them to class every class?
No, you don't need any materials in lecture other than a pencil to sign the attendance sheet. What you bring is up to you. And you're never handing anything in for points in the lecture room. But people will write down text simply because it's projected on a screen, even if I tell them not to. And that, of course, requires your attention to do. You might be listening to me in the background, but you're not giving me full attention. So I don't want you to do that, and therefore I don't include much text. It's there if you need it online to look at later. Instead, I'd rather you pay as close attention to me as possible while still writing notes. But just importantly, keep in mind that this should not be your final version of notes. You should expect to struggle if all you do is scratch down whatever you can during me sometimes quickly speaking. Write down what you can while still listening as closely as you can and asking questions. That's a big benefit of being here live, that you can ask questions. But expect then to substantially refine and improve those notes by listening to the recordings, making more specific notes about what I talk about, right? And then study the hell out of those notes. And by that I mean to the point of being able to give your own lectures. Some of you might have already noticed that on the Hoffman site, I have a page in which I give various recommendations for how to do well. And they're all important to at least try. Some of them will work for some people and not for others. But the one that I think is the most important, even though it's probably the one that the least number of students do, is to try to give your own lectures. By which I mean speaking out loud without looking at any notes. Now, you don't have to actually have an audience. It can be you in an empty room or you with a dog, whatever. But actually bother to speak it out loud and without looking at your notes for a couple reasons. One is that writing puts things into your brain in a certain place in your brain. Listening puts it into another place in the brain. Speaking it puts it in still another place. The more copies you can store of the information in your brain, the more likely that you'll be able to recall one of those copies, hopefully, during an exam, and therefore do well. So that's one reason for doing it. Another reason, though, has to do with what every instructor learns early on in its career, which is that you never really know how well you know something until you try to teach it to someone else. And it can be embarrassing with a real class in front of you, if you're a new instructor, because you can realize, hey, damn, I don't really know what I'm talking about. It's not embarrassing, though, if you're doing this at home as a way to study. And so not only does speaking help you store the memory, but it also allows you to know where you stand. So choose a major topic from a chapter, put your notes entirely away, and try to explain it out loud. You might be able to do that for a while. And if you can breeze through certain topics, that's valuable information because that tells you you've prepared that well enough. No reason to waste precious time relearning the stuff you already know well. But if you're a typical person, you're going to find a place where you get stuck because you don't know it as well as you thought you did by looking at the notes. And that's also valuable information. That tells you exactly where you need to go back to the notes and refine your knowledge until you can get to the point of actually explaining everything without looking at everything, anything. And if you can do that, if you can get to that point, then you are ready for one of my exams. Conversely, if you can't get to that point, then you're not ready for my exams, and that's when you're going to have to find a way to deal with the performance issue, okay? Which usually boils down to spending more and more time. All right, so that's how I work on the slides. I think it's best, I'm not going to police you, but I think it's best, and I'm glad to see it, that you just use the old school method of taking notes on blank paper. I think it's important also, though, to write down in your notes what the slide number is every time I change it, so that when you refine your notes, you're doing it in an orderly way. And I'll always announce the slide, hopefully, so you can hear it on the lecture. The slide number, by the way, is the red number. I tried to get all figure numbers out so they're not distractions. But anyway, this first slide has to do with the definition of life. This whole chapter is a pretty general chapter. It's also pretty short compared to the other chapters, but this first slide takes a lot longer than the other slides, so don't think that all of these slides are going to take this long. Anyway, what is life is an important philosophical question, but it's also an important biological question. Life, as it turns out, is not really an easy thing to define. But if we think about living things, that's really one of three categories of objects in the universe. If living things is one category, what are the other two? Yeah. Well, not dying, the process. I'm talking about categories of objects.
Oh.
Non-living is another category. And so what kind of objects are neither living nor non-living? What's the third category? This typically hangs up students on the first day, but you might be overthinking it. Third category is dead things. A dead thing is not a non-living thing. Right, they're distinct. A rock is non-living because it has never lived. A dead thing used to be a living thing and now is dead. See the distinction? So those are the three things, but really defining these has to do with defining what it means to be alive to begin with. And that, as it turns out, is not really so easy to do. It's not a nice, short, dictionary-type definition. It's really a matter of determining what all living things have in common, which is what this slide presents in these seven pictures. Life is a process, first of all. In terms of science, when you really get down to it, life is chemistry. And this is the first of two general biology terms. If you go on to the second one, which is 202, that studies life at a bigger scale than the cell. This is all about cellular biology. So what happens inside a cell, which is what life is, metabolism is life, That's really just chemistry. Metabolism is the sum of all the chemical reactions that are occurring within an organism. And that's really what life is. It's just chemical reactions. And so when you get down to it, biology is really just chemistry. But when you think about that, chemistry really, when you get down to it, is just physics. And when you get down to that, physics really is just math. So everything really is just math, including biology. But I keep using the word organism here, which is another word for a living thing. Not everything is an organism, of course. And there's a pretty clear-cut prerequisite, a structural prerequisite for being an organism. What is that? What do you have to have, structurally speaking, to be an organism? Yeah. You have to have at least one cell to be an organism. Yes. A virus, for instance, which is obviously in the news during a pandemic, is not an organism. And a virus is not alive. A virus doesn't have metabolism. It doesn't have those chemical reactions occurring that really are life. And so I hear this said incorrectly all the time by scientists on TV, but I think it's just because they want to make it accessible to the general public. They'll say that a certain chemical or treatment kills the virus. Well, the virus wasn't alive to begin with. It's interacting with living things, but it's not an organism itself, because a virus doesn't have a cell. Okay, you have to have at least one cell. Now, we obviously are multicellular organisms. The vast majority of organisms alive right now, and even more so, the vast majority of organisms that have ever lived, are unicellular. They're still an organism fully by having that one cell. But that's a fundamental difference between a virus, which is just a collection of molecules, and a cellular entity that has chemical reactions happening inside those cells. That, by the way, we'll talk more about the cell, obviously, but that's the big thing about a cell. It's like a little test tube in which a special set of chemical reactions that really aren't special in terms of life, they're just chemical reactions, but they're allowed to happen because you have a test tube that separates that solution from the rest of the environment. Just like you have a test tube undergoing chemical reactions in a chemistry lab. Right? You don't just have everything spilled out into everything. So that's the big deal about a cell. And only living things have cells. Well, regardless of unicellularity or multicellularity, all organisms, all cellular entities, exhibit all seven of these major characteristics. But there are also some non-living things that might exhibit one or more of these. It's just that they won't have all seven of these. Okay? Well, let's go through these then one at a time, starting with response to the environment. You already know that organisms respond to the environment. You live it, right? You touch something that's hot, you draw away from it immediately. Not because you're thinking that your hand is getting too hot. Before you can even create the sensation of pain, your body's already forcing you away from it. And similarly, you know, a unicellular organism might immediately move away from some chemical. There's all kinds of responses to the environment that are put in place by evolution that we'll get more into in a little bit to allow organisms to continue to live. If you didn't have a response to the environment, life would be a lot shorter. You would get killed. Reproduction. This is an example of one that some non-living things do. For instance, there are some crystals that can reproduce, but they're not living, right? Well, organisms have the capacity, at least, to reproduce. For instance, I've chosen not to reproduce, but that doesn't make me non-living or dead. I'll eventually be dead. Anyway, reproduction applies to all kinds of organisms, even if they're unicellular. By the way, speaking of multicellularity, do you have a feel for how many cells make up your body? Any wild guesses? It's more than one. It is trillions, yes. It's depends on the person, obviously, but 10 to 100 trillion cells in an average human adult. So a billion, which is a big number, is just a tiny, tiny piece of you. Cells are small things. By the way, that 100 trillion, that's your cells. By that I mean cells that have your DNA in them. Cells that came originally from the zygote you started out as, the single-celled zygote that you started out as. But what we call ourselves, the volume that we occupy, our body, is vastly outnumbered by other cells. So for every one of our own cells, and we have 100 trillion of those, there's between 10 and 100 bacteria living in and on us. So in terms of number of cells, we're mostly bacteria. Anyway, even single-celled organisms reproduce, obviously. They, in fact, that's an important concept in biology called cell theory. Where do cells come from? No idea? You have no idea where cells come from? Now, are you just not wanting to answer, or do you seriously have no idea where cells come from? Cells come from other cells. That's the important tenet of cell theory. Cells come only from pre-existing cells. At least nowadays, and it's been that way for a long time. Obviously, that can't have always been true, right? And we'll talk about the original cells in a different chapter. But ever since the first successful cells, you know, there is some successful cell that is the ancestor to every living thing on Earth. And cells don't just pop into existence anymore. They come only from pre-existing cells by cellular reproduction. Growth and development. Those are lumped into one, although they're different from each other. Growth, of course, is increase in size. Well, that certainly applies to multicellular organisms like us, right? We are no longer the size of the zygote we started as. That zygote is your official beginning in terms of legality, I guess. But even though that's where your identity begins, the zygote that you started out it was already represents 4 billion years of cells giving rise to new cells, right? Up until your parents producing sperm and egg that got together to form that zygote. But anyway, we're multicellular organisms, and so we're much bigger than the zygote, but we're not just a huge human-sized cell. As we just were talking about, we're trillions, tens of trillions of cells big. And so obviously that's part of growth. But growth also applies even to unicellular organisms. If you think about new cells coming into existence from pre-existing cells, that's true for a bacterium, for instance, a typical unicellular organism. One cell will split into two. Now obviously, since it's not magic, those two cells right away are not going to be the full size of the original one cell, right? So even individual cells grow. That's distinct from development, which refers mostly to multicellular organisms. So not only are we not one cell, one big cell, we're many cells, but we also are a collection of many different types of cells within our own body because they've gone down different developmental trajectories to become different organs, different tissues, and so on, doing different jobs within the individual. All right, energy processing is something we're going to focus on a lot during Unit 3, which will be probably score-wise the low point of the term, but hopefully you'll enjoy it. Really important because being alive, which means having those chemical reactions that we call, in some, metabolism happen, requires a continuous processing of energy. It doesn't happen just automatically or for free. There has to be a continuous input of energy and a continuous exchange of energy and materials with the surroundings. Organisms can't live in isolation, in other words. They're always exchanging, including energy. Regulation has to do with keeping things working the way they are to keep the organism alive. And so there's different feedback mechanisms that we'll talk about that help in regulation. There's all kinds of examples of regulation, but just like a thermostat regulates the temperature in a room, you also have a thermostat in your body that regulates your body temperature. But there's also all kinds of other variables that you regulate, like pH, for instance, and so on. Then there's order. Organisms in general exhibit a pretty high degree of order compared to non-living things. There are exceptions to this as well. Crystals is another example. Not only can they reproduce certain times, but they also have a high degree of order, even though they're not living. But just a run-of-the-mill non-living thing is not very highly ordered, usually, compared to an organism. Obviously, there's a high degree of order in this structure of a flower, but even organisms that don't seem to have such high degree of order really do have a high degree of order, microscopically at least. And that doesn't come for free, just like having a very orderly room doesn't just happen, right? You have to put energy into getting it that way. And that's one of the, you know, that order that organisms create and maintain requires a bunch of energy processing. So it harkens back to that. That leads then to the last one at the top, which is evolutionary adaptation, which is a phrase that we should examine both words for individually. Just outside of biology, in everyday language, what does it mean to adapt? Yeah. Yes. An adapter, for instance, if you use some sort of an adapter, you are changing the situation so that something works well in that new condition. Right? Like an AC-DC adapter, you can plug it into AC even though the device is using DC because you've adapted it. And that's what it means in biology. Adaptation is change in successive generations of a population in such a way that on average, the individuals in that population are better suited to the conditions in which they live compared to their ancestors. So that's just what adaptation by itself is. That happens as part of evolution, but what does evolution by itself mean? Once again, not in biology, just what does the word mean? What does it mean to evolve? Right. Probably the best single word definition is just change. Well, there are different ways, three different ways, as you'll learn about if you go on to 202, in which case you spend a lot more time on evolution in that course. Not 202, 182. There's three major ways that evolution occurs. But one of those is much more important than the other two. And that one mechanism that we care about in this course is natural selection. So natural selection is one of the ways, but the most important ways, in which evolution occurs. Now, a little bit ago I said that we're all, not just humans, all organisms, we're all descendants from a single original cell, the ancestor to all living things. Why is it that there are different kinds of organisms? Why aren't we just exact copies of that original cell that reproduced many times over and over. What is it physically, structurally, that makes different kinds of organisms different from each other, or even individuals? Everyone in here is different from the other people in this room. But when you get down to the cellular level, what's a major difference between you?
DNA.
DNA. The most famous molecule on Earth nowadays, and we'll spend half of the term talking about DNA, second half. But though I'll have much more to say about this later, I'll just say for now that DNA indirectly determines the traits of an individual. Not directly, indirectly, but that's not the point right now. Whatever DNA you have, which you got from the cells that you came from, indirectly determines everything, almost everything about you. Now, the environment plays a role as well, but you think the way you do, you taste the way you do, whatever, indirectly because of what DNA you have. Within a population of the same species, but also obviously between species, there's differences in DNA. But the original successful cell had DNA. How is it that there are new versions of DNA? New sequences of nucleotides that we call DNA. Which is just another way of re-asking, why aren't we just exact copies of the original cell? What is it that creates new versions of DNA? When a cell reproduces asexually, and that's all, you know, sex is a very recent thing. For almost all of life history, there's only been asexual reproduction, and there still is, obviously. So that original successful cell asexually reproduced into two new cells. Those were probably exact copies of the original cell, because that's what asexual reproduction does. It produces an exact genetic copy of the original cell. So how is it that there ever can be new versions of DNA, if that's true? Accidents happen, is the answer. What do we call those accidents? Mutations. Mutations are changes to DNA sequences that happen just by accident. Whether it's because the copying isn't perfect or a chemical interferes with the DNA and causes a mutation, like smoking, for instance. Whatever the case, mutations are just randomly occurring accidents. And if it weren't for mutations, then we would just be copies of that original cell. But as soon as mutation happens, which it is randomly, continuously happening, and within our bodies even, you know, not all of your cells are genetically identical anymore because mutation is occurring, especially if you expose yourself to things that can damage the DNA, like sunlight and smoking and whatnot, but just living. Anyway, once you have different versions of DNA because of these random accidents, these mutations, then you have, since DNA indirectly determines traits, individuals with at least slightly different traits, right? And since they're slightly different traits, that means you're going to have some individuals that are at least slightly not as well at coping with their surroundings as other organisms are that have slightly different DNA. Well, this is exactly how natural selection works. It's not a conscious selection. Nature is not choosing anything. We say it's natural selection simply because the random accident that happens to work better is more likely to be passed on as a copy of DNA than a different version of DNA in a different organism that doesn't do as well under those circumstances, right? So if a, you know, a random mutation is random, it's no, neither good, bad, or neutral. I mean, it's one of those three, but it's mutations don't happen for a goal. They just happen accidentally. And usually it's either neutral or bad for the organism. And if it's bad for the organism, then either that organism isn't going to be able to live at all, or it might live, but it won't survive long enough to reproduce. And reproduction is key here, because reproduction is the only way you're going to pass that version of DNA, whatever you have, onto the next generation. Well, if you happen to be a little bit better, you have a little bit of an edge compared to others because of the way your lineage has mutated DNA-wise, then you're going to have at least a little higher percentage of surviving long enough to pass that DNA version on to the next generation. Therefore, in each successive generation, that new generation's population will be represented by a higher fraction of this DNA that's better for the conditions. And it gets better and better because natural selection happens each time there's reproduction. That's all natural selection is. It's vastly misunderstood by the general public, but that's really all, as simple as it is. And so since we have different versions of DNA only because of random accidents called mutations, the accidents that happen to work better for organisms in their conditions are favored and get passed on with greater frequency. Now, notice, by the way, that things can drastically change. The environment can drastically change. Like if there's major earthquake or something, the new population might be living in an entirely different set of circumstances all of a sudden. And so that might suddenly favor individuals that were disfavored before. Now they might have the edge in the new conditions. But it's still going to be a selection for whatever gives individuals a better chance of surviving long enough to pass their DNA on to the next generation. All right. Slide 2 won't take that long. Here we're looking at what is called the hierarchy of biological organization. And a hierarchy in general is a nested arrangement of things. By nested, I mean that there are different levels, and each level contains a certain number of levels below it, and each of those levels contains a certain number of levels below it. Kind of like an outline is a hierarchy. I'm going to go through this in reverse order from small to big, starting with atoms. Now, atoms are not the smallest possible level, because atoms themselves are made up of even simpler things, and those are made up of even simpler things. In other sciences, those levels matter, but in biology, we don't really care about things below the level of the atom as far as the hierarchy is concerned. So we'll start with atoms. Atoms, of course, are not alive individually, right? They're just atoms. But the roughly 100 types of atoms that exist in the universe can get together in various ways to produce more complex structures called molecules. They're also not alive. And that's really what a virus is, a couple of molecules. But molecules have properties that atoms that make them up do not. This is an important concept in biology called... where the hell did my pen go? Emergent properties. To emerge means to come out, right? Emergent properties refers to properties that one level has that the levels below it do not have. So until you get those atoms together into a molecule, you don't have the properties that the molecule has, right? Similarly for all of these levels. Molecules, though, of different types get together to form more complex structures called organelles, which is a word that literally means small organ, just by analogy with our human body, right? You have organs that make you up, like liver and kidney. Well, within one cell, there are little structures, kind of like organs within the cell, called organelles. We're still not to an organism, though, right? Because these are all subcellular structures below the level of the cell. Organelles come in different varieties. We'll talk about those later. But a collection of organelles makes up a complete cell. Now we're finally at living. Because you have to remember to have at least one cell to be an organism. Only when you have a cell with its boundary, the plasma membrane, that makes a little test tube in which all of the metabolism that's occurring as chemical reactions inside that cell can happen in isolation, do you have life. Now, for the vast majority of organisms, which are the unicellular organisms of the world, the cell level and the organism level that we haven't gotten to yet are the same thing, right? So they wouldn't exhibit these other levels in between. The next few levels are only for multicellular organisms, like us. Cells of different types collect into more complex structures called tissues. And how many types of tissues and what they are depends on the species. We animals are made up of connective tissue, nervous tissue, muscle tissue, and epithelial tissue. Plants also have tissues, but they're different tissues, and so on. But each tissue is a collection of different kinds of cells that together are performing a certain function. That's another emergent property, right? The tissue has properties that the individual cells don't have. Well, tissues of various kinds get together to form more complex structures called organs, and this is listed as one, but these are two separate levels. Organs is a level by itself. So the skin, for instance, is an organ, the liver is an organ, and so on. Collection of tissues together performing a certain function or set of functions. Multiple organs then are arranged into even more complex things called organ systems. For humans, for instance, there are 11, circulatory system, reproductive system, and so on. Those are collection of organs that are functionally related because they do something in common. And then when you collect all the organ systems, however many it is, together you have the full organism, a multicellular organism, that is. And so an organism is an individual, like each of you. Well, in a given place, there isn't just one organism. There are usually many organisms of the same species. And that collection of all the organisms of that same species is called a population. So within a given area, there's a human population, a deer mouse population, all living together, right? But each collection of just one species is a population by itself. When you include all of the populations in the same area, then you have the next level, which is a community. You see the difference between population and community? Population is just all the members of a single species there. The community is all the living things in that same area. All the species. Now, how is community different from an ecosystem? That's exactly right. Right. You might have been tempted to say that since a community is a collection of populations, that an ecosystem is a collection of communities, but that's actually not true. The community is all of the living and dead things in that area. All the species. The ecosystem is that community plus all of the non-living things as well. The water, the air, the rocks, that's part of the ecosystem. They're not part of the community. Okay? Then the only remaining step is the biosphere, which is spherical in shape because of the planet we live on is spherical, and because the only evidence, definitive evidence we have for life is on Earth so far. And likely will always be that case, even though it's almost certain that there's plenty of life out in the universe that happened the same way it happened here. It's just that the spaces between things in the universe are so vast that the chances of us ever meeting any other life, very, very tiny. If it ever does, we'll have to expand the biosphere to include them. But the biosphere is a spherical shell with a thickness to its wall. And that thickness actually keeps getting bigger and bigger because one edge, the inner edge of that, is far deep into the earth or the oceans where we continue to find living things. And where we thought it was impossible to live before, we keep finding things deeper and deeper. So that's one edge of the shell, the inside. And then we also keep finding things farther out in the atmosphere that are alive. Not just birds, which are of course part of it, but microscopic life. And so that's the other edge of the thickness. And that's changing. But if we find life outside of Earth, then it'll no longer technically be a sphere anymore. It'll be much bigger. Now, what the hell time is it? We go until 2:15, is that right? I'm going to stop here simply because we had non-connectivity in this room for the section that's right before you, and this is where I stop for them, so it's a good place to break. Gives you a couple extra minutes before lab, which is right downstairs, but enter through the south side of the building, room 103, I think.